I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. It's summertime, and with high gas prices, a vacation may be out of reach for your budget. But no matter what your finances look like, you can definitely afford a trip to your local library. Today, the Book Doctors are here with all the latest reads for the summer. Whether you're a serial bookworm, casual reader, or haven't cracked a book in a while, there's something for everyone. So grab a lawn chair, get some sun, and get ready to open up the coolest titles this summer. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. Well, the Book Doctors are in the house. They'll give us an update on some good summertime reads and tell us what's new in the world of good books out there. Our Book Doctors today are Grace Suh. She's a writer and blogger. And Grace, nice to have you.
Good morning.
Welcome
back.
Thank you. Jeff Van Gowdy is a freelance writer, editor, and reviewer. Jeff, nice to have you too.
Thank you, Steve.
Good morning. Gina Kaufman, our old buddy from her days co-hosting the Walt Bodine Show, is here. She's author of More Than Petticoats, Remarkable Kansas Women, and Gina is one of those remarkable Kansas women. How are you?
Oh, thank you. I'm
nice
pretty
to
good.
Have you, Gina. Yeah. Mark Luce is also back. He's chair of the Department of English and senior dean at the Barstow School. Mark, good morning to you too.
Good morning.
Well, Jeff, what's the hot book out there these days? What are people talking about?
You know, in my circle, people are reading and studying and try to make sense of the Kansas redistricting map, to tell you the truth.
That's what where the focus is right now.
Yeah, I would say so, trying to make sense of that.
Mark, what are you hearing out there?
Not much.
I tend to
stick to my own. I've stopped reading the Publishers Weekly and all of those things.
Why is that?
Because I'm too busy.
Yeah.
And I'd rather have things sort of come to me through people that I know and trust than try to keep up with the industry.
Yeah.
The only thing that I notice is that on the Amazon bestseller list, 7 of the 10 books are either the 50 Shades of Grey Plus and the 50 Shades of Grey box set or the Hunger Games trilogy.
Remind everybody what the Shades of Grey book is all about. In 20 words
well,
or less.
You know, it's about things that you really can't talk about on the radio.
How about one word?
Whether it's derogatory or not, the term for it is mommy porn. It's just a spicy books about a spicy couple.
We talked about that last time I think you all were on. Grace, are people talking about that book still?
Only to apologize for reading it.
A little bit of that going on, right? Yeah. Gina, anything going on you've noticed?
I'm kind of in the Mark Luce camp. I mostly talk about books with other writers, and I think writers read not based on what's come out recently necessarily, but based on the questions that they're pursuing in their own writing. So it's all over the map for me.
Well said.
Okay, let's go to some good books that you guys have been looking at. Mark Luce, why don't you start us off here with Toni Morrison and her book, Home.
You know, it's funny that you say that, Jeannie, because I didn't even know until basically the day before this came out that she had a new book coming out. I had no idea. And I stumbled upon it. I looked at it on the computer, and I'm like, oh, is that new? Because I figured, Toni Morrison doesn't have a new book out. And so sure enough, it was. So I got it immediately. I absolutely love her work. This is a slim volume. It's only about 160 pages, and it's fairly big type.
Mm-hmm.
It's a story about a fellow named Frank Money. And Frank has gone to Korea, where he has seen some horrific things in the war. And he comes back. He's on the West Coast when he comes back. And he's clearly suffering from what we would call today PTSD. And he tries to massage that with drink and ends up doing things that he's sort of not aware of. He's got a coiled sort of violence in him from what he's seen with his buddies. He gets a note from a family friend that says, you need to come, and if you don't come and get your sister, she's going to die. And he and his sister grew up in Lotus, Georgia. Their parents had basically abandoned them. And so he has to make a journey across the country in order to retrieve his sister from this. It's never really specified, but it seems to be sort of a doctor who's into eugenics of some sort. Mm. And so what we really trace is Frank trying to find find the courage to get himself sort of right, to get himself strong in order to go back to this place that he hates in order to save his sister. Now, it's not – I mean, it's Toni Morrison, so it's extremely well written. I mean, it's just absolutely beautiful.
And it's as good as the stuff she's done before.
Well, this is – no. But that said, she's Toni Morrison, so even her stuff that's not as good is still pretty much better than most other writers.
Yeah.
It's much more spare than something like Beloved or certainly Song of Solomon. It has a lot more in common with maybe Sula, like one of her earlier books. But it's nice to read. It's pleasant to read. You really grow to like Frank. And it's fairly quick. You know, I saw her recently. I saw a picture of her with the president, and she looks – I mean, she's older.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, I wonder if maybe we'll get a couple more of these more small novels. But it's absolutely spectacular. It's Toni Morrison home.
Okay. Jeff Ann Gowdy, how about Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake by our buddy Anna Quinlan, who was just in here a couple of weeks ago talking to us about this book.
Absolutely, Steve. I actually listened online to your interview with her this week, and I thought it was really good. You have wonderful interviewing skills, and she was spot on in her observations. But I don't really think this is a memoir. I don't think there's the level of personal candor that we expect from a memoir. To me, it's like a series of essays or plumpish columns with memoirish asides.
Yeah, I agree with that.
I'd call it memoir light. That said, she's a brilliant commentator, and there's a lot of really good stuff that she commentates on in here. And one of these essays is called Push, and it's about the cult of uber-momism.
Yeah.
where certain highly educated women feel they have to sort of justify their decision to stay at home full time with their kids by becoming professional moms or hover parents. And also liked how she talked about the pressure that I grew up with, the 50s, keeping up with the Joneses is now keeping up with the Joneses' kids.
She's really concerned about that uber momism. It's way overdone, and she's concerned about it.
Yeah. And she's quite good about that. But she says she's almost 60, and she's perfectly satisfied, and she wouldn't change a thing. And I think that comes off to some readers as smug and self-satisfied. The Newsday reviewer said, no more cake, please. The New York Times book reviewer said, there's too many hugs on every page, and stop squeezing me already, Anna. But I think she's spot on cultural and political stuff. When she talks about the Catholic Church, when she talks about politics, I'm there with her. Sometimes I think she doesn't kind of reckon the level of privilege that she has in her life. But you know what? I like her.
Well, I think she was pretty self-effacing when it came to her own rise in journalism, and she was pretty point blank about the fact that she rose because she was and is a woman, you know, and that's her story.
That is a good point. That's absolutely a good point, that there were women who filed suit against the New York Times, and she had to be – the New York Times didn't have very many women, so she was one of those hires.
Right place, right time, and off
she
went.
But when she's talking about, like, her country home and, you know, it's like – ouch.
Yeah. Okay. That's Lots of Candles, Plenty of Cake by Anna Quinlan. That interview is on our website, kcur.org. Gina Kaufman, Discomfort Zone by Jonathan Franzen, the new one by Jonathan Franzen.
It is not actually
the
new
one.
Yeah. You know, okay, I've recently started a job in Lawrence, Kansas, so I've been commuting, and that's a new thing for me. So I have also been listening to audiobooks, which is additionally a new thing for me. My reading style doesn't work well with audiobooks in general because when I read, I like to stop for a moment and kind of have my own thoughts about what I've just read and then continue. And when you do that while listening to an audiobook, you're lost. And I just find myself frequently lost with audiobooks. But my first couple of months as a commuter have been lessons in what works for my style of reading as an audiobook listener. And I found some interesting insights about what makes a really good audiobook, which is not necessarily the same as what makes a good print book. And I would say that Discomfort Zone by Jonathan Franzen, I think that's the way to read that book. I read reviews of it, and they're bad. That is not a well-reviewed book. And the criticisms that I read of the book, I was surprised because I loved it, having listened to it and having listened to the author read it. But the reviews made good points, and I realized that those were things that not having the author's intonation as he read and the personality that you get from his delivery, his vocal delivery, would change things and would make it feel like just the most unbearably self-absorbed memoir, which is saying a lot because that's the whole idea of a memoir. So for it to be catapulted to that level because it deals with minutia of essentially an ordinary life. But the way he...
So it is a memoir about his life and who he is and where he came from.
It is. And it begins with his mother has just died and he's doing the job of selling her house. And as he's going through the house and finding things and getting a real estate agent on board and all of that, he's catapulted into memory by rehearing the refrain that his parents used to both say every time they made an improvement to the home, which is, it'll sell the house. And of course, they had no intention of ever selling the house. And in fact, his mother had kept files about what other houses in the area sold for. But the idea was that someone else was going to be doing this later, and this was going to be her great, you know, creation in life was this house that was going to sell. Mm-hmm. It was going to really sell. Mm-hmm. But that catapults him into memoir. And it's, I think, really well done. And the reason it works so well in an audiobook is that each chapter is like its own tight creation. The way that it starts is usually with memoir. And then he goes on some really long tangent. In one case, it's The Peanuts by Charles Schulz. In another case, it's birding, just the activity of birding. But he always very subtly and tightly and without too much ceremony brings it back into memoir, where suddenly that whole digression feels really closely tied into his own personal story. So for the short attention span listener out there, it's fulfilling in the way something long is fulfilling because it does bring you back, but it takes you on a lot of digressions in it's like it's very conversational and a wonderful listen.
He does have a new book out, doesn't he?
Yes.
I just read, yeah.
And
I don't know.
I'm blanking on the title right now. I'm very sorry.
Yeah. Okay. That's Gina Coffin with her first one, Discomfort Zone by Jonathan Franzen. Grace has been very patient here. Tell us about Radioactive.
Oh, okay. Well, I absolutely adored this book. And as you can see, I'm showing everybody in the room, it's a gorgeous graphic novel. And
which are more in vogue than ever.
Yes, they are more in vogue than ever. This one is a really interesting one. It's not in any sort of comic strip form, as many of them are. And it's furthermore, it's not really a plot. It's the life of Marie Curie. Hmm. And you know, obviously the radio listeners can't hear this, but the graphic style looks as though they're kind of X-ray pictures. So the artist employed a certain printing style that makes the pictures both kind of luminescent, appear almost as though they're glowing, and also unusually dark. They're really moody pictures. They're not exactly – it's not a graphics story in the classic sense where you're following someone's actions and the pictures are helping to illustrate the actions. They're really just kind of mood settings. Hmm. And a lot of times the text is interposed onto them. And, you know, they're kind of, I don't know, some of them are kind of Edvard Munch-y, and some of them are kind of Egon Schiele-ish, you know, with a skeleton kind of look. They're very interesting.
Well, the fact that it's a graphic novel, does that mean this book is for younger readers or not?
Well, you know, honestly, I was tempted, because her story is so interesting and inspirational, I was tempted to try to get my 8-year-old daughter to read it, but it's at the level is far too high for her. But I would think that it could work for middle school kids and definitely high school kids.
It's inspirational. Why?
Oh, her life is phenomenal. Mm. I mean, she's born in Poland, and she's just a brilliant student. And she goes to study at the Sorbonne, and she's the first woman ever to receive a doctorate. She's the first woman ever to become a professor at the Sorbonne. Mm. She's the first woman ever to receive a Nobel Prize, and she receives two. Not only that, but her daughter, who goes on to continue her work, then wins a Nobel Prize based on her mother's work. She's a genius. She's, she's a friend of Einstein's. She's a friend of great leaders in her day. But she also has this incredible personal life where Pierre is the love of her life, but he dies fairly early. Not because, as you would think, because of all the effects of radiation, although it had a hugely deleterious effect on their health, but because he's run over by a horse and wagon on the street. And then she's one of the big scandals of the day because she enters into an affair with a married man. And this happens shortly after the Dreyfus affair. And so she's wrongly accused of being Jewish. And all these newspaper articles are saying these Jewish scum with their horrible morals rooting the French nation, which is all false. And so she has this really interesting personal life. They were involved in seances. They had all sorts of interesting friends. She's a remarkable, remarkable woman.
Interesting book.
So juicy.
I have a question, actually. Ed, did the author have an introduction about why the author chose to do a graphic representation?
Well, she is a graphic novelist, so her previous book was a graphic novel.
Yeah. Okay, if you're just joining us this morning, you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. We're visiting with our book doctors today. They are Grace Suh, Jeff Ann Gowdy, Gina Kaufman, and Mark Luce. We're running through a whole bunch of good books that you might want to consider for summertime reading. Mark Luce, you're up next here with A Movable Feast by a man named Ernest Hemingway.
Yeah, you know, graphic novels are so in vogue that I'm teaching a class on graphic novels right now at University of Kansas.
Wow.
That's how in vogue they are.
Mm-hmm. That's pretty in vogue.
Arrived.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's a class on comic books.
Oh, is that what it is?
No. It's more, they're more sophisticated than that, of
they're
course.
They're supposed to be.
They're supposed to be more sophisticated than that. Well, I was lucky enough a few weeks ago to get a vacation. And so Jen and I went to Paris for a couple days, and then we stayed for a week in Bruges. And so since I was going to Paris, I decided that it was very important to read Hemingway's A Movable Feast, which I devoured on a very long airplane ride, very unpleasant airplane ride, too, stuck in the middle of a three-seat overnight.
Flight. That's not good.
Yeah.
That's not good.
It wasn't good. And
the guy next to you was snoring.
He was just rude.
On you, too.
He was just rude. He was just...
Really?
Yeah, it's like standoffish and rude.
Yeah.
But, you know, the thing, this was published posthumously. Hemingway had sort of worked on it, you're not quite sure when, but over the years. And basically what he does is he talks about life in Paris in the 20s and how wonderful it was. We meet Gertrude Stein. We meet F. Scott Fitzgerald and his crazy wife, Zelda. We meet his first of three or four wives, Hadley, and we really just kind of get to know the city. He takes us around the city. Right. It's written, of course, in the very spare form, and it's a lot of talk about art and a lot of talk about writing and a decent amount of drinking.
Mm-hmm.
I bet.
And, you know, people sort
just
of
like
floating.
The movie. Yeah, the Woody Allen film.
Yeah.
Yeah,
kind of. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. The good parts of the film, like when they were in the old, like when they were in the 20s. It's the same sort of thing. And I found it to be, you know, I don't think it's his masterpiece by any stretch of the imagination, but I found it extremely pleasant and a perfect way to pass a few hours and learned a little bit more about like how those circles at that time worked. You know, whether you could just drop by Gertrude Stein or if she'd be grumpy or, you know, F. Scott always sort of trying to control his crazy wife.
So are you one of those folks who wishes you could have been back there then or could go back there tomorrow for a while and just visit back in the 20s?
No. I don't think so. I think I would rather be in Chicago in the 20s or New York in the 20s. Mm-hmm. Louis Armstrong, maybe. Not Paris, not so much. Yeah. Maybe Paris, like, before the war, more than after the war. You know, the crazy anarchists and stuff. I think it'd be a little more fun.
Yeah, yeah. But you liked it.
Oh, loved it. I mean, I absolutely loved
classic.
It. Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Jeff, The World Without You.
Okay, The World Without You is a novel by Joshua Hinken, and he's the director of the creative writing program, the MFA program at Brooklyn College. And this book is going to come out next week from Pantheon Books. And I had an interesting reaction to this book, which I wasn't going to mention because I knew people would jump on me, but I'm going to go ahead.
Yeah.
when I was reading this book, there is so much density of detail about feelings. And I kept thinking, a guy wrote this book? And I think, gee, that's such a sexist reaction. You know, Jim, I really have this reaction.
Yeah.
But anyway, I'll put it out there. And I know Mark will take me up on this. But
nah,
anyway. This is the story of the Frankels, and they get together on a July 4th weekend in 2005 to memorialize the death of the younger son, who was a journalist in Iraq and who died the year before. And basically, it's about grief and how people grieve in different ways and mm-hmm. the way grief reconfigures a family. The mother is a physician, and the father is a retired teacher, and they have a big secret they're going to divulge at the start. The mother is taking to the op-ed pages of newspapers to rail against the Iraq war, and the father is grieving silently. Leo, the dead brother that they're coming to memorialize, his widow is coming, and his three sisters are coming. And of the three sisters, I thought Noelle was the most interesting. She was the wild child when the kids were growing up, very promiscuous, very crazy. And she's done a 180, and now she's an Orthodox Jew living in Jerusalem with a real prickly husband. And I know you're supposed to critique the book that is and not the book that's not, but I wish it had just been Noelle's story.
Mm-hmm.
These are rotating narratives, and a lot of narrative threads drop. And Noelle had the most dramatic tension. She changed the most, and I wish it had just been essentially her story.
Hmm.
But Josh Hinken's The World Without You, it's going to be published next week.
Oh, so you got an advanced copy here.
Actually, he Facebook messaged me and asked me to review the book, which I thought was kind of roguish.
Wow.
But anyway, it's a good book. It's getting some advance praise, some buzz. It's a Goodreads featured book, and he's got a lot of...
Do you know him?
Not at all. No, zero. Huh. He said he was...
He stalked you on Facebook
actually,
to get you to write a review.
Actually, what he said was that... I didn't, though. I mean, but I'm talking about it here.
Yeah.
I mean, it's a book that I can recommend with reservations. He said he was actually a fan of my book reviews, and I said, oh, which ones would those be? And he said, well, da-da-da-da, and just
really?
From memory, da-da-da-da. And so he is a student of book reviews who cruises, you know, the pages and reads the Kansas City Star.
So he was able to respond to your question.
Absolutely, because I was like,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, well, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Wow.
That's hustle in the new age.
Are you publishing a review of it?
No.
I was going to say, he better be careful what he wishes for.
Yeah, flattery gets you almost everywhere.
Why do you think that was roguish when he did that?
I think as a reviewer, you try not to review books by people you know because mm-hmm. it's hard to give an objective opinion.
Yeah.
And even having somebody approach you is just makes you feel a little compromised. Like the couple of times I did book reviews for the New York Times Book Review, I had to sign a thing saying that I did not know the author. I did not know anybody, you know, involved with the production of the book, blah, 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 you know.
Yeah, it's I've never had anybody Facebook message me asking for a review. But when I did far more reviews, not uncommon.
Mm-hmm.
But it does make you – it's like, you know, you don't do – let your publicist do that. Let
– Exactly.
You know, or maybe
–
I mean, I guess you could send an email.
It looks a little amateurish.
Yeah.
That way?
Yeah.
It's too amateurish?
I think it looks amateurish.
Yeah,
like,
I do too.
Well, I always feel sorry for these folks, though. I mean, these authors put in so much time, so much effort in these books, and gosh, they come out, and they are so desperate to get some attention put on their hard work. And a lot of these guys, these folks who write these books, on their own dime, they travel the Midwest, the country, and they come in here and talk about their books, and God, you just feel for them. So in a way, I guess I don't blame them for Facebooking Jeff Van Gowdy. Maybe that's a good strategy.
You know? He actually did get a starred review in Publishers Weekly.
That's pretty good.
And he got a respectful review from Kirkus, and Kirkus can be pretty snarky.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, I liked it.
Yeah.
But I have to say that I felt compromised from the get-go. It's like...
Mm. Even from that one contact?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, no, then he wrote me to tell me he got a starred review. He kept writing me, and then I didn't respond.
Wow. Okay, well, if you want to join our conversation...
Now he's probably listening to the... He'll listen to the archives on the Kraske Show.
Yeah.
Well, that's fine.
He'll probably call in here in a few minutes.
Hey, I gave him respectful treatment.
Well, let him call. And here's the number, 816-235-2888. If you have a good recommendation for a good summertime read, fiction, nonfiction, we're open for all recommendations here. Give us a shout. Again, 816-235-2888 or email us uptodate@kcur.org. Or go to KCUR's Facebook page. Gina, you're up next with a book. What book is that? That's Hideous Kinky.
Yeah.
And wow. Yeah.
You know what?
How
when
hideous
I went to
was
the,
it?
Okay, that's the first thing I'd like to address is the title.
Please.
Thank you, Steve. It's by Esther Freud, and she is, in fact, the great-granddaughter of Sigmund. But it's not what it sounds like. And I don't know whether that's a really good trick that she has pulled or a really unfortunate miscalculation of her audience, because the source of the title is a game that two children play. They've heard these words. There's a character in this who uses words these children have never heard before, and they create a game of tag that comes from two of the words that this character has used that are mysterious, exciting words to them.
Mm-hmm.
So this book is neither hideous nor kinky. And it was made into a movie in, I believe, the late 90s, maybe.
Mm-hmm.
And it starred Kate Winslet, who is unfortunately on the cover. It doesn't do anything to make you look better when you ask for help finding Hideous Kinky in the library, and it's got a sultry-looking Kate Winslet on the cover. But the movie is also, I think, a slightly unfortunate thing, because although it was a good movie, I had seen it before reading the book. The movie is from one character's perspective, and the book is actually from a totally other perspective. The book is about it's semi-autobiographical. Esther Freud was taken with her sister by her mother from London to Morocco in the 70s to experience a fuller, more in touch with things that matter kind of life than the staid London experience. And the movie focuses on the mother's spiritual quest, whereas the book is from the child's perspective, the unwilling participant in the adventure. And the child doesn't question whether the mother should have gone or shouldn't. The child is just there. And the true adventure is for the child to try to understand what's going on around her, find some kind of stability, and really to survive in some cases within this book. It is, I have to say, I'm shocked, but it is one of the most beautiful books I've ever read.
Wow.
And the reason is that this author is the master of that cliche about writing the show, don't tell. But most people who really pride themselves in doing that heap detail upon detail upon detail, making sure you get it. She picks that one perfect detail and just leaves it alone. There's one scene where the children, well, the whole family has been in a van that has broken down with a mattress in it. And you don't quite understand. She doesn't say, we were driving a van and there was a mattress in it and we were all crowded onto a dirty mattress. She slowly unloads details, but when they arrive at a hotel where someone has taken pity on them and let them come and stay the night, the last line of that chapter has her experiencing the unfamiliar cool of clean sheets. That detail is all you need. Another writer might have given you all the details in the hotel that contrast with all of the details of the van, but just, and she didn't even say, remember we were on a mattress, you know. She didn't do that. She just left it alone. It's very elegant, and it's also remarkably compassionate, knowing that this is based on her own experience, that this on some level is her own story.
Mm-hmm.
When you read certain scenes about these girls like protesting that they want to go to school, I think that when you put this from the perspective of the mother's journey, you can't help but think, what are you doing to your children? And you think that a little bit from the daughter's perspective, but what you feel more than judgment for the mother is fear for the child.
Mm-hmm.
when you move it to being their story. And I think also with the mother's story, it's hard to feel compassion when things are rough because she chose this. Whereas with the daughters, because they didn't choose this, it really ups the stakes, I think, for the reader. And it doesn't let you off the hook when it comes to compassion. It's a beautifully written book, and I can't recommend it highly enough.
Very high praise from Gina Coffin for A Hideous Kinky, a book title you'll never forget, As Long As You Live, by Esther Freud. Hideous Kinky. Again, our number here for your recommendations for great summertime reads, 816-235-2888. Let's go to David from Kingsville, Missouri, with a book very close to my heart. David, good morning.
Good morning.
Hi.
My recommendation is what I think is the great page-turner of the summer, which is the most recent volume of Lyndon Johnson by Robert Caro.
I am halfway through it, David, and I couldn't agree with you more. And you're breaking a streak of all fiction books here with a good nonfiction pick. I'm glad. What do you like about it, David?
Well, I like everything about it. I like the fact that Caro has decided to divide the last volume of Lyndon Johnson's biography into two volumes so that he can write in one book about one absolutely magical period in American political history, which is the period between November 22nd, 1963, and, let's say, March of 1964. The accomplishments of Lyndon Johnson in that very short period of time were just absolutely amazing. And obviously the character of Johnson is going to change. Beginning in 1964, he's going to become the big bad guy we all grew up hating because of the Vietnam War.
Right.
But to highlight this period and the accomplishments of this man is just wonderful. And, of course, Caro is just a spectacular writer.
Boy, I couldn't agree with you more, David. You know, I'm just through the part in the book where Johnson is feeling so bored because he's got nothing to do as vice president of the United States. The Kennedy administration is completely shunning him. And for the first time in all of these volumes, I actually feel sorry for Lyndon Johnson, knowing how much he craves power, how good he is at using it, and yet this man is sitting one heartbeat away from the most powerful job in the world, and he's absolutely got nothing to do.
Oh, and of course, I think there's a sort of a backhanded compliment there that you're making, which is to Robert Caro, because he's writing about a period in Johnson's life when there is nothing happening, and you're still turning the page.
Oh, it's riveting. I just find it, you can't hit my sweet spot better than with this book by Robert Caro on LBJ, the series of books, just spectacular.
Absolutely.
David, I appreciate your phone call. Thanks for taking the time. You bet. Bye-bye. Let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with our book doctors here about some good summertime reads. And again, if you want to join our conversation with your suggestions, 816-235-2888, our email address, updatedate@kcur.org, or go to KCUR's Facebook page. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. And welcome back. I'm Steve Kraske. If you missed yesterday's talk about myths and mysteries of Kansas and our update on redistricting in the Sunflower State, you'll find it and all of our previous broadcasts at kcur.org. Tomorrow on the program, author Jeff Shera's take on the Battle of Shiloh, plus Brian McTavish returns with our weekend to-do list. That's tomorrow on the program. This hour, we're visiting with our very good book doctors about some good summertime reads. They are Grace Suh, Jeff Ann Gowdy, Gina Kaufman, and Mark Luce. And let's see, who's up next year? Grace Suh, why don't you take one here? The Cat's Table, or what do you have up there?
I'll do Cat's Table.
Yeah.
This is a book I read last week, and I really enjoyed it. It's by Michael Ondaatje, whom most listeners would know as the author of The English Patient, a book they might not necessarily have read, but certainly seen the movie. This is a novel about a young boy, 11 years old, who goes on this huge passenger ship from Sri Lanka, his home Colombo, Sri Lanka, to England, where he's going to go to school. And he quickly makes friends with two little boys who are the same age. And because they're from upper-class families in Sri Lanka, but families that still don't have very much money, the boys are sent on their own without a chaperone because the families can't afford the extra passage. And so for the first time in their lives, these boys who are strangers at the beginning but quickly become friends are alone on their own, free reign of this big boat. They go everywhere. They go down to the engine rooms. They sneak into all these places they shouldn't go. They throw lawn chairs into the pools. They kind of go wild. And it's just a fascinatingly structured book. The interesting thing about Ondaatje is that he's a poet, and his language is so remarkable. But unlike a lot of literary writers, his books are just packed with plot. And this is so eventful. I mean, he's very tricky because, you know, it being a boat and a journey, you already have so many things going for you because they're constantly meeting new passengers. And because they're kind of invisible, they can see all these plots and all these things going on that are untoward or strange, and they're trying to make sense of it. And there's a big mystery because there's a prisoner on board who's always in shackles, who only gets to go out at night, and the boys hide in a lifeboat and are always watching this guy and trying to figure out, what did he do wrong? Where is he going? And there are a lot of other mysteries and different subplots, and they notice all these things like the guy who reads fortunes in the evening is actually a different person by day. Mm-hmm. He wears a costume. And so they figure out all these things. And it's really fun. I'm making it sound kind of Tom Sawyer-ish, but actually it's more Huck Finn-ish because there are all these very dark themes running throughout. Mm-hmm. And the other really interesting thing about the book is that makes it dark in retrospect is that the little boy's name is Michael. And Michael Ondaatje is from Sri Lanka, and he was educated in England. So then it sets up this little prickling question in your mind the whole time that you're reading. You don't even hear the name Michael till about page 60. And then all of a sudden I sat up and I thought, wait a minute, is this autobiographical?
Yeah, right, sure.
So, and there's a murder, there are deaths on board. You get to the end and there's a very small note that says this is – this, despite appearances, this is not autobiography. And so, which, you know, who knows?
Which means it's autobiography.
Exactly. Yeah. And so there's all this metafictional layering going on that adds to the intrigue of this book.
That's the cat's table. Sounds like a good book.
Another book by, I think it was in 1976, he published a novel called Coming Through Slaughter, which is an experimental sort of book. It's about Buddy Bolden, the cornet player, set in Storyville in New Orleans. And it's his sort of descent into madness. It's like set in 1907. And it's very different, it sounds like, structurally, because in the earlier work, it's fragmented. It's almost like jazz riffs. Mm-hmm. It also deals with this photographer, E.J. Belloc. But I've always enjoyed his work, and this one sounds like that sounds. You talked about your sweet spot with the LBJ, two little boys on a boat spying on people. That's pretty much right in mine.
That's cool. That's very cool. Yeah. Okay, let's go to some phone calls here. Folks calling in with their picks for some good summertime books. Let's go to Jake from South Kansas City. Jake, good morning. You there, Jake? It only took, just for the record, 45 minutes for someone to call in about Shades of Grey. Jake was going to talk about it. We didn't quite get to him. Let's go to Sherry from Overland Park. Sherry, good morning.
Good morning. I was going to recommend Unbroken by Laura Hildebrandt, which is the true story of Louis Zamperini, who is an Olympic distance runner who becomes a, and I would say this wrong, bombardier on a fighter pilot in World War II. His plane gets shot down. He survives many weeks at sea and becomes a prisoner of war. And it's just a really compelling page-turner. I was skeptical. Like, I didn't want to read a war story, and it was – I couldn't put it down. It was fabulous.
Well, sure. I think you joined the legions out there. I read that book, too, for a book club, and it's just – I thought it was just a spectacular book, just a terrific read. So, and a great summertime book, too.
Yeah, yeah. It was terrific.
All right, Sherry. Thanks for the good call. Appreciate
it. Thanks.
Bye-bye. Trace from Lee's Summit. Trace, good morning.
Hey, how are you doing?
Well, thanks.
I have a book from a local artist called Denise Grover Swank, and her book is 28 and a Half Wishes Later, and it's about a young woman in Arkansas who kind of has visions, and one morning she has a vision of herself dead, and she works at a DMV, so it kind of like startles her, and it turns out her mother ends up dying, and she goes on this crazy kind of, she gets thrown into this whole case detective case trying to figure out who this murderer is in her town. It's just a really humorous read. My wife picked it up, and I ended up reading it, and I didn't think I was going to like it. I thought it was hilarious, and so I just thought it would be a great, lighthearted summer read.
And the title is what again, Trace?
28 and a Half Wishes.
Okay. Thanks for the call.
Thank you.
Let's go to Mark from Kansas City, Missouri. Mark, good morning.
Good morning. Thanks for taking my call.
Hi.
Hi. Collection of short stories that I'm just finishing. Nathan Englander is what we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank, which is just, it turns poignant and hysterical, and I really enjoyed it.
Nathan Englander.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
What we talk about when we talk about Anne Frank.
Huh.
And the second one is Julie, I'm not sure I'm pronouncing her last name right, Otusaka, The Buddha in the Attic.
Excellent book.
Jeff's nodding her head.
Just great.
Wonderful book.
What's good about it, Mark?
The writing is at times lyrical and beautiful, and the subject, it involves some Japanese sort of brides coming to America, and it sort of not chronologically arranged. Each chapter is about a different aspect of their lives.
All right.
And it ends with the beginning of the roundups for the internment camps.
Mm.
But just beautifully written.
The Buddha in the Attic, Gina?
Yeah.
Mark,
and it's about 150 pages. I found it a pretty fast read.
I was just going to comment on the Nathan Englander recommendation. If you enjoyed that essay, he wrote a book called For the Relief of Unbearable Urges, and it's a great work of fiction. And it sounds like it might have that same combination of sort of heaviness, but also not heaviness.
Yeah.
Does Englander just steal other people's titles and twist them?
Yeah.
I mean, because that's Carver and Kundera back to back.
I guess that is his trick.
Jim from Kansas City, Missouri. You're on with the Book Doctors. Jim, good morning.
Good morning. 11/22/63 by Stephen King.
And why'd you like it?
Well, it was classic Stephen King, but the monster in this one is time, because they kind of start messing with time and try and go back and change the Kennedy assassination. But aside from being classic Stephen King, it also has love and justice, and you really get into the character, the main character. You can really have an affinity with him, so it's just a really good read.
Okay. I'm glad you called, Jim. Thank you.
Sure.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Mark Luce, tell us about El Postino.
El Postino is a novel written by Antonio Scarmeta. Most people will probably know it from the film called Il Postino that came out, oh, goodness.
In the 90s.
In the 90s,
yeah.
Sometime in the early 90s. A gorgeous film. The star of it, I'm going to butcher his name, Mario Torrissimo, died right after it was made. Mm-hmm. And I think it got an Academy Award for Best Foreign Film. The novel has been out of print for a long time. I had read it before the film came out, really enjoyed it. And I'm always looking for it. And then finally, this year, it was reprinted. And it's the story of sort of this hapless postman who falls in love with this woman. And he only has one postal customer. And his postal customer is Pablo Neruda, the poet. And
wow.
So he goes, he tries to befriend him, and Neruda sort of, yeah, okay, buddy, see you later. But then he sees this girl, and he falls in love, and she's gorgeous, and her name's Beatrice. And so he starts to get lessons from Neruda on kind of how to love.
Mm-hmm.
So on one hand, it's a wonderful love story, but at the same time, there's there's a dark sort of political backdrop with in Chile with Pinochet, and so it's sort of two novels in one, but mostly it's just a magical story of a man sort of falling in love with this beautiful woman and the troubles that he sort of finds himself in. It's short and it's beautiful.
Well, that sounds great. Sounds terrific, Jeff. The Age of Miracles by Karen Thompson Walker.
Yeah, Steve, you were asking about what book are people talking about. This book goes on sale June 26th, and I should have a review in the Star on the 24th, so I'm going to be a little bit cagey. But The Age of Miracles by Karen Thompson Walker. She wrote this when she was an editor at Simon & Schuster. She wrote it in the mornings, and it took her 3 years. It became the subject of a huge bidding war. Hmm. It sold for $1 million.
What a great feeling
Random
that
House.
Would be. Yeah.
And sold for £500,000 in the UK. And it's a wonderfully crafted book. It's simply told. It's the story of when the world's rotation or the Earth's rotation suddenly slows down. And daytime becomes very long, nighttime becomes very long, birds drop from the sky, crops fail. Ultimately, the Earth's magnetic field has a tear in it, so it's an end-time novel. It's narrated by Julia, who's a young adult when she narrates it, but she harks back to 11 going on 12. So it's simply told. It's beautifully told. It has a lot of metaphorical unities. Given the climate change that we've been experiencing, I found it chilling and menacing. Is it worth a mill? What book is? I think in these hard economic times, publishers are looking for the next big thing, and they think this is going to be the next big thing. So I would recommend it. It's a very artful novel that will scare you.
The Age of Miracles by Karen Thompson Walker.
So I'm gonna ask. So you say that it's artful. Does that mean that it's not soulful?
That's a good point. I mean, it's chilling. It's depressing. It's also soulful, yes. I mean, it's a girl's story. She goes through puberty. She has a crush. She's bullied because she's a quiet outsider. Her parents' marriage is strained, and she starts noticing that. That's very credibly done. It becomes more strained with the problems of the planet. So it's both a coming-of-age tale and a really scary sort of environmental end-time novel.
Is it like The Road Light?
You know, I have to say I didn't read The Road, but yeah, I've heard you talk about it, Mark, so I'd say yeah.
All right, Grace, how about Diane Brady's book, Fraternity?
Can I switch it up on you?
You can switch it up and go Diamond in the Rough by Sean Colvin.
Well, thank you.
Yes.
That's where I'd like to go, and I have to admit that I have a little bit of not self-interest, but personal interest in this book because I edited it.
Oh, good for you.
I don't know if people are that familiar with Sean Colvin. She's a Grammy Award-winning singer-songwriter who probably had her biggest heyday in the 90s. But she's just a, you know, this is just a really fascinating memoir, even if you are not that familiar with her work, which you should be because I love her, because she has worked with everybody from Lyle Lovett to Mary Chapin Carpenter to Neil Young to James Taylor, and she tells stories about
how did you get hooked up with her?
It's very weird, but long story short, I have a friend who's a New Yorker editor, and so I guess I owe her 10%.
Yeah. There you go. There you go.
But it's really it's her life story, and it's really fascinating because she grew up in a little town in the Dakotas called Vermilion that had about 500 people in it, and she used to sing Beatles songs to herself, and went to college and became a folk singer because that's what you did back then. Worshipped Johnny Mitchell, who was just coming up, and was lost and didn't do so well in school and didn't know what to do with herself, made her way to Greenwich Village when it was kind of a songwriting haven.
Right.
And started singing around in bars and ended up being there was a songwriting collective, and one of the songwriters was one Suzanne Vega. And so that was right when that took off, and she went on tour with Suzanne as a backup singer. She was really a nobody. She had no money. She had an alcohol problem. And she decided, no one's going to do this for, but me. No one's going to do it for me. I have to do it for myself. And so she just knuckled down and started writing songs and produced her first album. And the rest is history. But it's a really fascinating history.
Diamond in the Rough by Sean Colvin, right?
That's right.
Gina, how about Fraud by David
I love that book.
You know, this is part of my audiobook experiment that I'm doing. And I will say that this doesn't quite come to the point of Discomfort Zone by Jonathan Franzen, but this was my second place. David Rakoff is part – the premise of this book is that he, as a journalist, is thrown into various situations, and his approach to doing that – different journalists approach the situation differently. He does not acknowledge that he's a journalist. He just kind of pretends to be one of the people doing this thing. So that's why it's called Fraud, is that he pretends to just be a guy who wants to go hiking when he goes on a big hike of a mountain that he's really, like, pretty ill-equipped to take. Mm-hmm. And so what I would say is I'll start with the flaws, which I would say – this is a little bit dated already because we've already left the era of editors send journalists to just places of random interest and then they just tell us what they experienced for no particular reason, mm-hmm. but because people had that luxury. It feels strange already to listen to, I'm listening for, why are you there? Why did they let you go? Mm-hmm. What are you trying to tell me? And the answer is nothing, for no reason. And that's already just totally weird. And it has not been that long. This is from the early 2000s. It's kind of delightful in a quaint, charming, old-fashioned way. But it's also kind of frustrating when I find it frustrating now, which is just a little interesting to me. And another thing that's dated about it is I think people have a reduced tolerance for snark. Mm-hmm. So what's good about it is that David Rakoff really writes for the ear. And he usually comes to the realization that those he's been mocking by the end, he kind of comes around to seeing it their way.
Hmm. That's say it again. It's
Fraud.
Fraud by David Rakoff here. Yeah. And Mark, you had a couple of the ones that remain. What do you recommend?
Oh, Alison Bechdel has a new graphic novel. She wrote Fun Home, which was about her father. And the new one is Are You My Mother? A comic drama, not to be confused with the Are You My Mother? The children's book.
All right.
Very, very different.
I want to thank our book doctors today, Grace Suh, Jeff Ann Gowdy, Gina Kaufman, and Mark Luce. Thank you all very much.
Thanks for having us.
Thank you.
Okay. Tomorrow on the show, learn more about one of the greatest battles in American history when we talk with author Jeff Shera about his new Civil War novel, A Blaze of Glory, plus our weekend to-do list. The show is produced by Steven Steichman. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.